But if you close your eyes.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to This Week Again. I'm your host, Suzanne Posel. We're going to start off this show with how CBS killed their journalistic integrity. Move on to highlights from Jack Smith's closed-door testimony to Congress, and follow all of that up with the GOP's latest efforts to rig the 2026 midterms. Let's begin, shall we? With some of the last-minute bullshit crammed into 2025, a season of our lives filled with plot holes, forgotten characters, and a half-baked ending that could have only been written by the Duffer Brothers.
What the fuck was that? What the fuck was that?
Starting with that 60 Minutes expose on the Trump regime's kidnapping and trafficking of migrants for torture's sake that was conveniently postponed until further notice by the dipshit CEO hired to appease the Burger King's dementia-fueled dream of controlling American media, which backfired in their face as soon as some Canadian uploaded the segment to YouTube and literally became the hero Americans never knew they always needed, prompting CBS to obstruct the free flow of information they were prepared to share with all of us until hours before going live by copyright violating all over any account that uploaded the segment. And all for the easily debunked reason that the segment wasn't fair and balanced, showing the Trump regime's side of the story. And that's because...
The Department of Homeland Security declined our request for an interview and referred all questions about CECOT to El Salvador. The government there did not respond to our request.
Well, they might not have anything to say about this, but I sure fucking do. Because I got my grubby little hands on a copy of the entire 60-minute segment and downloaded it so I could share with you what the Schmuck House, Ice Barbie, and Tom Barely a Human Borders are don't want you to know about the criminal enterprise they're calling deportation. Beginning with the fact that Cruella DeNome and her Department of Racist Profiling knows that the majority of migrants they've sent to El Salvador's CECOT prison were not criminals, and the ones that were only guilty of crossing the border illegally. Roll tape.
Juan Papier is a deputy director at the nonprofit Human Rights Watch. In an 81-page report released in November, the organization concluded there was systematic torture and other abuses at CECOT, and that nearly half of the Venezuelans the U.S. sent there had no criminal history. Only 8 of the men had been convicted of a violent or potentially violent offense.
How do you know they weren't gang members?
We cross-referenced federal databases in all 50 states in the United States, and also obtain criminal records in Venezuela and in the countries where these people lived. And the information we obtained in the United States is based on data provided by ICE.
So ICE's own records said?
ICE's own records say that only 3% of them had been sentenced for a violent or potentially violent crime.
60 Minutes reviewed the available ICE data. It confirms the findings of Human Rights Watch. It shows 70 men had pending criminal charges in the U.S., which could include immigration violations. We don't know because the Department of Homeland Security has never released a complete list of the names or criminal histories of the men it sent to CECOT. Rapid deportations have been a key part of the Trump administration's immigration overhaul. The administration considers anyone who crosses the border illegally to be a criminal. Illegal crossings are now at a historic low.
Well, well, well. Turns out that Karening, the Preschmuckretary Kristi Noem and Chinflab Un did about the migrants they're deporting being the worst violent criminals this country has ever seen, was just white people being racist.
You didn't see that coming?
So with that in mind, it's probably safe to say that the estimated 250 migrants that were sent to CECOT to be tortured and later used for props in propaganda videos from the maggot content creators and the puppy killer herself weren't even gang members to begin with.
the U.S. government said, these people are the worst of the worst.
These people are migrants. And the sad reality is that the U.S. government tried to make an example out of them. They sent them to a place where they were likely to be tortured, to send migrants across Latin America the message that they should not come to the United States.
Some immigration attorneys say the administration has used flawed criteria to justify deportations.
I have some tattoos. None of them have anything to do with any criminal group. I explained to them, saying that I didn't belong to any gang, to which the agent responded, but you are Venezuelan.
60 Minutes reviewed this document agents used to assess Venezuelans. A person with 8 points was designated as a Tren de Aragua gang member and deportable. Tattoos an immigration officer suspected of being gang-related earned 4 points. But criminologists who study gangs say tattoos are not a reliable way to identify Venezuelan gang members because, unlike some Central American gangs such as MS-13, Tren de Aragua does not use tattoos to signal membership.
Because, of course, they don't. Tattoos being the mark of a criminal is some boomer ideology going back to the mid-1900s when beatniks, sailors, and low-income rebels were the cat's meow and all good white boys and girls wouldn't be caught dead all inked up. And considering the deteriorating mindset of a 79-year-old molding bag of oranges running this country, is it any wonder their frozen Gestapo is looking for tattoos and saying, yep, that's a bad hombre? Not the documentation from all 50 states and their home of origin showing that they were no threat to anyone. Probably because reading is hard, but mostly because they're proud to be able to racistly profile black and brown people who came to this country seeking asylum, knowing some of the people they kidnap will be going to other countries to be tortured, like these men experienced in El Salvador at CECOT.
We met Luis Munoz Pinto in Colombia. He was a college student in repressive Venezuela and hoped to seek asylum in the United States. In 2024, he says he waited in Mexico until his scheduled appointment with U.S. Customs and Border Protection in California. During that interview,
they just looked at me and told me I was a danger to society.
You have no criminal record.
I never even got a traffic ticket.
Nevertheless, he was detained by customs. He says he spent 6 months locked up in the U.S. waiting for a decision on his asylum case when he was deported. One of 252 Venezuelans sent to CECOT between March and April. Inside, he says, their hands and feet were tied. Forced to their knees, their heads were shaved.
There was blood everywhere, screams, people crying, people who couldn't take it and were urinating and vomiting on themselves. 4 guards grabbed me, and they beat me until I bled, to the point of agony. They knocked our faces against the wall. That was when they broke one of my teeth.
So you had to be on your knees for 24 hours.
Yes, because they put a guard there to watch us so that we wouldn't move.
And what would happen if you could make it?
They'd take us to the island.
What's the island?
The island is a little room where there's no light, no ventilation, nothing. It's a cell for punishment where you can't see your hand in front of your face. After they locked us in, they came to beat us every half hour. And they pounded on the door with their sticks to traumatize us while we were in there.
The torture was never ending.
Interminables.
They would take you there and beat you for hours and leave you locked in there for days.
Some of the deportees described being sexually assaulted by the guards.
They were hitting your private parts?
Sí.
With a baton?
No.
No, they tugged at them with their hands.
And they did that to multiple people?
A su mayoría.
To most of us.
Food and medicine were often withheld.
Did you have access to clean water?
They never gave us access to clean water. The same water from our baths and toilets was the same water that we had to drink and survive on. If we had serious injuries, when the doctors examined us, they told us that drinking water would heal it.
So they're telling the injured prisoners to drink water, and the water's filthy.
Super sucio.
Super filthy.
Mientras más mal nos vieran,
the sicker and more injured we were, the better it was for them.
Are you starting to understand why the dictator Todd did not want this 60 Minutes segment to air? They knew for a fact these migrants were not criminals when entering the country seeking refuge. And the gangs they claim that these people are from don't have matching tattoos in lieu of membership cards. They know for a fact they're lying when they say migrants came into this country illegally when they have asylum cases open but magically are dismissed, so they're no longer here legally in the technical sense, and of course that makes them dangerous criminals. And they know for a fact these people are being sent to El Salvadorian equivalent of a concentration camp, where torture is a feature, not a bug. And all for the taxpayer-funded price of nearly $5 million.
This year, during a meeting with President Bukele at the White House, President Trump expressed admiration for El Salvador's prison system.
They're great facilities, very strong facilities, and they don't play games.
In March, the U.S. struck a deal to pay El Salvador $4.7 million to house Venezuelan deportees at CECOT. The Trump administration has arranged more deals, some valued at millions of dollars, to offload U.S. deportees to other so-called third countries, nations to which they have no connection. Among them, war-torn South Sudan and Uganda, which have well-documented histories of torturing prisoners.
Because, of course, these melanin-challenged dickheads are looking for other countries to send anyone in the United States who doesn't look like they should be on an American Eagle commercial. And for that matter, it appears as though the Trump regime has decided it would be so much easier to just take over Venezuela instead of dealing with all those pesky boat bombings they've been doing recently. Last Friday night, El Capitan ordered strikes on Venezuela, kidnapped their president and his wife, and flew those people to New York, where they're being held, with charges coming soon, of course. And as far as the country of Venezuela, yeah, Placido Domingo has decided he's going to keep it.
We're going to run the country until such time as we can do a safe, proper, and judicious transition. So we don't want to be involved with having somebody else get in, and we have the same situation that we had for the last long period of years. So we are going to run the country. We can't take a chance that somebody else takes over Venezuela that doesn't have the good of the Venezuelan people in mind. We've had decades of that. We're not going to let that happen. We're there now. And what people don't understand, but they understand as I say this, we're there now, but we're going to stay until such time as the proper transition can take place. So we're going to stay until such time as we're going to run it, essentially.
From a stage at Mar-a-Lago that once housed thousands of stolen classified documents, General Fatten announced, "We're just going to keep Venezuela until he can find someone else to run it." And of course, I'm sure ExxonMobil will be getting back to work in Venezuela after being kicked out of the country in 2007 for refusing to renegotiate oil drilling contracts back when Hugo Chavez was in charge. But then again, what do I know? I only suggested on my last show that Maria Machado, who won a Venezuelan election in 2010, and the Nobel Peace Prize in 2025, Invasion Dawn wanted oh so badly, would be the special sauce Exxon needed to get their grubby hands on Venezuelan oil again. But I digress. We're talking about what a piece of shit Barry Weiss, the editor-in-chief for CBS News, is for ruining 8 decades of news broadcasting to appease a dementia-ridden, diaper-wearing fossil with a dead raccoon taped to his head, or, as Rachel Maddow quite eloquently explained.
You'll recall it was only a few months ago that CBS and its parent company were bought by the family of one of Trump's billionaire supporters, And as part of the Trump administration's approval of that deal, CBS's new owners promised to install a Trump-friendly conservative minder to keep an eye on the CBS newsroom. They also installed this new editor-in-chief, who is now being accused by the journalists she oversees of politically interfering in their work. The reason this is causing a revolt is because this is how, bit by bit, the free press, the independent American news organizations that give us a free press, instead become state TV. And that is a matter not just for the billionaires who are playing with these things for their own benefit and the executives who have decided to enable them. It's also a matter of public interest. It's a matter of national interest. Earlier this month, Congressman Jamie Raskin wrote to CBS News and asked them to account for edits that appeared to have been made to a 60 Minutes interview at President Trump's request. He said, quote, "It's one thing for CBS to make independent editorial decisions protected by the First Amendment. It's quite another to make edits at the president's demand out of fear of retribution. The American people deserve to know whether their news is shaped by journalistic judgment or by Donald Trump. The American people deserve to know."
And it looks like we do now. Barry Weiss decided to can a completely vetted story exposing the Trump regime as human traffickers for all the racist reasons, because the facts in the story made them look like the Nazis they are. But thanks to a Canadian uploading the entire segment to YouTube when it aired in Canada by accident, we all know what they didn't want us to know. Oh, and while we're on the subject of things King Baby Coward doesn't want you to know and me to talk about, how about that Jack Smith behind closed doors testimony the Dems in Congress released during the holiday season? Best Christmas gift ever! We got 8+ hours of testimony and 250 pages of his final report on Crimes the Clown's attempt to overthrow the U.S. government by sicking tens of thousands of his Mule Team Sixers on the Capitol, armed with fists full of shit, literally, and a gallows with Mike Pence's name on it. And now I present to you the most important parts of Jack Smith's testimony to Congress. Roll tape.
Our investigation developed proof beyond a reasonable doubt that President Trump engaged in a criminal scheme to overturn the results of the 2020 election and to prevent the lawful transfer of power. Our investigation also developed powerful evidence that showed that President Trump willfully retained highly classified documents after he left office in January of 2021, storing them at his social club, including in a ballroom and a bathroom. He then repeatedly tried to obstruct justice to conceal his continued retention of those documents. The timing and speed of our work reflects the strength of the evidence and our confidence that we would have secured convictions at trial. We want to make clear that this was not about trying to interfere with anyone's First Amendment rights, that this was a fraud. And as you know, under Supreme Court precedent, fraud is not protected by the First Amendment.
But the president's statements that he believed the election was rife with fraud, those certainly are statements that are protected by the First Amendment, correct?
Absolutely not, if they are made to target a lawful government function and they are made with knowing falsity. No, okay. They're not.
I mean, there's a long list of disputed elections.
There is no historical analog for what President Trump did in this case. Mm-hmm. What he was not free to do was violate federal law and use knowingly false statements about election fraud to target a lawful government function. Mm-hmm. That he was not allowed to do. The president got information from people he trusted on other issues. He rejected it whenever it didn't fit him staying in office. And there was a pattern in our case where anytime any information came in that would mean he could no longer be president, he would reject it. And any theory, no matter how far-fetched, no matter how not based in law, that would indicate that he could, he latched onto that. We had evidence that would indicate from some point, might have been closer to December period, that Bannon, who had been out of touch with President Trump for some period of time,
got back in more regular touch with him at some time. And that's right at the same time that these calls are happening, after he refused to do what he could to stop the attack on the Capitol, after the tweet about Mike Pence.
Our witnesses were not going to be political enemies of the president. They were going to be political allies. Donald Trump directed his co-conspirators to call these people to further delay the proceedings. He chose to do that. Responsibility for why these records, why we collected them, that lies with Donald Trump.
Well, I understand that. Nobody disputed the speaker and the president were having communications on January 6th. So one way you could have gotten that information is you could have asked the speaker's lawyer to look at his phone records and to give you the information you needed, right?
Well, you say now that nobody's disputing, but my experience in criminal investigations is that people often at trial dispute things that you never thought were going to be in dispute during the investigation. And so when I conduct a criminal investigation, I don't assume there will be no disputes. Having a record that is a hard record about a time and the timeline of that afternoon was particularly important because that violence started. The president refused to stop it. He endangered the life of his vice president. Then he's getting calls, and not calls from Democrats, not calls from people he doesn't know, calls from people he trusts, calls from people he relies on, and still refuses to come to the aid of the people at the Capitol. That's very important evidence for criminal intent in our case.
Senator Josh Hawley claimed that the subpoena of his phone records was, quote, hacking his phone. As part of your investigation, did you or anyone from your office tap the phone of Senator Hawley?
No.
So is his suggestion that his phone had been tapped just simply false?
It's inaccurate.
Do you believe that the Supreme Court's decision on executive immunity constitutes an exoneration of President Trump's conduct in the months and weeks leading up to January 6th and January 6th?
No. I understand the Supreme Court decision. They took a view of executive power that was more expansive than what we argued. Our view was that he abused his authority in the Justice Department to effectuate the scheme. This was about him as a candidate trying to say he won an election he didn't win, that there was substantial evidence that would allow us to prove the case beyond reasonable doubt. We analyzed the evidence against different co-conspirators. My staff determined that we did have evidence to charge people at a certain point in time. I had not made final determinations about that at the time that President Trump won re-election, meaning that our office was going to be closed down.
And just so that we're clear, the reason why we're living in this Nazi Germany idiocracy is because of an unwritten policy at the DOJ called the 60-day rule that says the department should avoid public statements, investigative steps, or charges against candidates within 60 days of a primary or general election for the sake of political neutrality. Now, there is no federal or state law stopping the DOJ from indicting or prosecuting a presidential candidate. They just don't do it for appearances. Not because the evidence proving a crime has been committed does not exist, not because the case against the person wouldn't end in a conviction, no, just because that's the way they've always done things, and no matter the consequences of allowing a criminal who cheated his way into the job is currently holding is going to change any of that. And to that I say,
this is some bullshit.
Especially because at the end of the day,
the evidence here made clear that President Trump was by a large measure the most culpable and most responsible person in this conspiracy. These crimes were committed for his benefit. The attack that happened at the Capitol as part of this case does not happen without him.
January 6th. The shit-smearing storming of the Capitol, the police officers who were beaten, and those who died due to their injuries, all of it wouldn't have been possible without the lying tangerine's mantrum over losing the 2020 election. Absolutely none of it. It wouldn't have happened. Jack Smith had solid evidence of how the coup came about, which Republicans were involved, and a whole bunch of shit no one even knows about because the criminal target is squatting in the People's House, shitting all over himself now at the Resolute desk, in between naps during press conferences. But instead of the version of reality that we all deserve, we're dealing with the crap like federal funding for childcare in all 50 states is now frozen because a swallower YouTuber and several of his masked friends had the caucasity to demand entry into a childcare center in Minnesota, only to be denied for being a creepy PDF.
This all comes in response to a viral video posted by a MAGA content creator. He claims that he uncovered widespread fraud by Somali-run child care centers in the state. The Deputy Secretary of Health and Human Services is taking the allegations at face value.
Intrepid journalists have made shocking and credible allegations of extensive fraud in Minnesota's child care programs. We believe the state of Minnesota has allowed scammers and fake daycares to siphon millions of taxpayer dollars over the past decade. Starting today, we require a justification receipt or photo evidence before we make a payment.
However, the so-called evidence comes from a man who has posted anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant content in the past.
This is MAGA YouTuber Nick Shirley. Back at a daycare in Minnesota, he alleged was a fraudulent facility in a now viral video.
People are going to say this is a left or right issue, but no, fraud is fraud.
And
so I'm not out here trying to put a twist on things.
Shirley's viral video, released over the weekend, in which he says he's uncovering tens of millions of dollars in fraud at Minneapolis daycares run by the Somali community, was retweeted by Elon Musk and Vice President J.D. Vance. In the video, Shirley tries to open locked doors and talk to people at various daycares he claims are frauds. Did you come during their normal operating hours when you came to visit?
I came at 11 a.m., I believe, and I also came the following day later in the day. The point of it is not whether or not I came at the right time of their operation hours. The point is that blacked out doors, they can't give you any information. You call that number, no one answers. I wasn't trying to go inside, and there should be a way for somebody to actually be able to call that number and somebody be able to answer. These aren't real businesses.
But surely you don't think a daycare should just be unlocked. You shouldn't be able to just walk into a
there
daycare.
There should be a reception.
No, every daycare is locked.
Their doors are locked.
And so, okay, you bring up a fair point. Then why can't they actually give me information how to enroll a child?
Do you think that federal law enforcement hasn't done enough? I mean, they would say, look, these fraud cases have been going on, but they've already done like 80 indictments. The cases have been going on, you know, for years.
And why did I show up one day in Minnesota and go to all these daycares, no children, they're receiving millions of dollars. We uncovered nearly $110 million in fraud in one day.
How do you know that all the allegations that you're making are true?
How do I know that they're true? Well, we showed you guys what was happening, and then you guys can go ahead and make your own analysis.
We're coming so we can make our own analysis. Are you 100% sure you're true?
Yeah, I am 100% sure I'm true.
At the daycare where Shirley showed back up, a stream of children walk inside. You're saying that this is a fraudulent daycare. There's kids being dropped off right now.
Yes. The commissioner of children literally said a week ago this place was closed.
Did you know
they're
that?
Showing face right now.
Dozens of fraud cases that DOJ is touting began during the Biden administration. Back in 2022, the U.S. Attorney's Office for Minnesota announced 47 indictments for this massive fraud scheme. Since then, they've indicted more than 30 more people, and in total, they have secured at least 56 convictions.
Wow, the audacity of one Nicholas Shirley is very next level. As believable as the Duffer Brothers' explanation for all the bad writing they did in the last season of Stranger Things. But first off, it helps to know that a daycare will be open during operational hours, and that's probably when you're going to want to speak to someone on site. But then again, when a rando white guy and several masked dudes start shaking the front door, demanding to be let in when they have no business being there in the first place, I wouldn't say that's a welcoming sight. And that goes for calling a business when they aren't open. because no employee is going to answer the phone before or after the place is open. Come on. It's almost like you come from a rich family and you've never had to work for a living. But most of all, if Nick the Dick is looking for some fraud, he might want to talk to his dad and mom, who have a history of being defendants in fraud cases where it turns out they're the fraudsters. Yep, back several years ago, Paul and Brooke Shirley, parents of Nick, allegedly decided to illegally move corporate assets after they filed for bankruptcy, you know, to avoid paying their debts. And for those of you in the back, this is a scheme that rich folk use to get out of paying their bills. Oh, and in case you're wondering how that all turned out, well, the whole thing settled out of court. So Nick's parents don't have to admit that they were wrong. They walk away scot-free, deflecting from their own fraudulent ways by literally showing up with their son to harass Somali daycare workers. Because how else was barely legal and self-proclaimed 22-year-old virgin of a son that they had gonna know the ins and outs of fraud if he doesn't get a first-hand look at it from his parents?
You are right. I learned it by watching you.
And while we're on the subject of fraud, 2026 is the year of the midterms, and no one knows they're gonna lose more than every single Republican holding office of any kind across this entire country. Now, there are several schemes in the works to prevent the voters from having the government representation they voted for, but a new component of the next election thievery has just reared its ugly head, and I thought you should know about it. Roll tape.
The USPS is changing its postmark process, and it could affect the way you send important mail like bills and ballots.
For decades, a postmark used to show when mail was accepted by the post office. It was used as proof that an individual met a deadline for things like a tax return or a mail-in ballot. But now, the postmark will reflect the date an envelope is first processed by an automated sorting machine, not the drop-off date.
That becomes very important if, say, you're mailing your mortgage payment or your utility bill, and that must be postmarked by a certain date in order for you to avoid a late fee. Or, say, if you're mailing your election ballot, and it has to be postmarked by a certain day in order for your vote to count.
Ah, now we're getting somewhere. Because for years, the guy who mails his ballot in has been complaining about mailing in ballots, which is hilarious on its own. But now the post office, run by a Cheeto-ringed mouth breather unironically named Louis DeJoy, and appointed by Eric Stad during his first occupation of the White House, isn't thrilled about the idea of efficiency, since that means the not-for-profit USPS would have to step up its game instead of not doing their job, which has been the case for the last 5 years. So when it comes to important documents like bills, court documents, election ballots, the USPS is now recommending that we all either file our shit early or pay upwards of $5 to $6 extra to make sure our letter or package arrives when we need it to. Like, say, Election Day. Because in Trump's Merca, it costs extra for service when we're already paying for that service every time we buy a stamp. And last but certainly not least, the thing Pervert Hoover doesn't want anyone talking about. Did you happen to catch that pathetic excuse for releasing the Epstein Files Pick Me Bondi authorized right before Christmas?
In this odd Christmas week, this Epstein document dump week. Because what we're witnessing in real time is an illegal cover-up in plain sight, a bungled cover-up, problems with posting, taking down, reposting, redactions, putting up slices of material, and then adding real-time tweets about it as if they haven't had all this time to prepare.
So they are illegally right now trying to catch up to what Congress mandated for them to do. And as far as what they have put out, I mean, it's laughable when most of what they put out was either A, already public record, half of them. The other pieces that they released were highly redacted. And in some cases, entire documents, not one word was actually left on there for the public to see. What clearly is happening is a White House cover-up.
The Justice Department has released 30,000 more pages of documents related to Jeffrey Epstein. According to the DOJ, some of these documents contain untrue and sensationalist claims made against President Trump that were submitted to the FBI right before the 2020 election. To be clear, the claims are unfounded and false, and if they had a shred of credibility, they certainly would have been weaponized against President Trump already.
The photos, more than a dozen of which, were redacted after being released.
According to the Associated Press, at least 16 of those files that were originally released on that Friday big dump have disappeared from the DOJ website.
There were a number of photographs that were pulled down after being released on Friday. That's because a judge in New York has ordered us to listen to any victim or victim rights group if they have any concerns about the material that we're putting up.
There's that one photo that we saw of a desk where there's a President Trump photo there. We are blurring it. He also mentioned there are other people who are in protected classes for ongoing investigations or national security concerns that have also been additionally redacted.
Okay, so there is a lot to unpack here. Like the fact that the Epstein Transparency Act only allows for redactions when it comes to the victim's likeness, personal and/or identifying information, but that's it. Not protected classes, not people involved in ongoing investigations, and certainly not in the name of national security, whatever the fuck that means. So that's the first what the fuck is going on with this release. On top of that, the fact that everything was supposed to be released by December 20th. Everything. That was the law. Then there's the fact that they are releasing things that are already public knowledge or pages that are just blacked out. Oh, and let's not forget, there are pictures that were there, then they weren't, like the photo on Jeffrey's desk, or the photo of Jeffrey with a photo on his desk, showing Molesty Dawn with several women in bikinis that turned out to be Epstein's victims, and the DOJ's Tom Blanche explains it all away, or so he thought.
Said you were referencing the 15 files released Friday. They disappeared from DOJ's website yesterday, including this photo of what looks like a desk with a drawer open containing photos of Donald Trump. Just to be very clear, to put a fine point on it, why were these files taken down? You're saying it was at the direction of a judge?
Well, you can see in that photo, there's photographs of women. And so we learned after releasing that photograph that there were concerns about those women and the fact that we had put that photo up. So we pulled that photo down. It has nothing to do with President Trump. There are dozens of photos of President Trump already released to the public, seeing him with Mr. Epstein. He has said that in the 90s and early 2000s, he socialized with him. So the absurdity of us pulling down a photo, a single photo, because President Trump was in it, is laughable. And the fact that everybody's trying to act like that's the case is a reflection of their true motivation. But the reality is anybody, any victim, any victim's lawyers, any victim rights group can reach out to us and say, hey, Department of Justice, there's a document, there's a photo, there's something within the Epstein files that identifies me. And we will then, of course, pull that off and investigate.
So you're saying that the photo you pulled down showed Pedo 47 with several of Epstein's victims, and we're not supposed to be like, our president should actually be on a registered sex offender list. And as far as redactions are concerned, to undo them as easy as copy and pasting a redacted file page into a Word document and voila, you can read everything that was blacked out. That, folks, is because of Doge. They thought, stop paying that Adobe Reader subscription way back when, you know, when they were breaking our government from within under the banner of waste, fraud, and abuse. Karma, she's a hell of a girl. But wait, there's more. Because according to the DOJ, the files are filled with lies about their dear leader. Like, there's something in the files about a story about a young woman and several girls who also worked at the Mar-a-Lago spa, but were sent to Epstein's home for private massages where they were assaulted. Then there is that little ditty about a 13-year-old in 1984 who was sex trafficked on boats in Michigan, where she says her baby was killed by her uncle and Marlardo just stood there watching, which also happens to be about the same time Groper Cleveland had a casino boat operating on Lake Michigan and Jeff was hanging out with children he met at the Interlaken summer camp in Michigan. So I suppose we're not supposed to think that's sus at all, right? Kind of like how we're supposed to be shocked, just like the DOJ pretends to be, over the Southern District of New York's new 1 million Epstein dock dump no one knew about until right about the fuck now. Really? Come on. We all know this is
a bullshit. A bullshit. A bullshit. Bullshit.
And that's all I have to say about that. New episodes of This Week Again air every Sunday. You can follow me or the show on lots of social media spots all across the interwebs, and we are always available for your listening pleasure wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you so much for listening to this show. Ta-da for now.
Taylor Swift and Travis Kelsey now in case Katy Perry kind of went to space. Nothing beats a jet to holiday. TikTok band for a day. Dollars on the boo-boo craze. Now they want a country Grammy. Everybody else is Stanley. Season 3 of White Lotus. History's really not like us. Cracker Barrel changes logo. Never mind, it's back to normal. Dodgers win the World Series in a 7-game thriller. Can 100 men take one gorilla? All the kids say 6-7. No, I was a doctor again. In the bit. Sinners was a vampire movie. Was a heist about the Louvre. Hopefully had a kiss scam. Steve ruined sunken damn cities. Speaking wore some jeans. Seems to find a stranger thing. Secret lives of Mormon wives. Way too many celebrities died. Bates was throwing a wedding party. Morgan Wallen's God's country. Wicked slow press door. And it's now a show. Throw a new pope from Chicago. Hip-hop demon hunters got a feeling. Pretty sight. It's the end of the year as we know it. It's the end of the year as we know it. And I feel fine.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
These are difficult times. And if you believe in justice, progress, and democracy, the news you read and listen to can be pretty depressing. And that's why there's a new podcast called Good News for Lefties and America. Every day it features positive news stories for progressive listeners. Because no matter how disturbing the headlines might be, there's always hope we can build on for a better tomorrow. Good News for Lefties and America. Listen on this platform at goodnewsforlefties.com or wherever podcasts are heard.